All right, we're here on case 11-1066, the state of Ohio versus Lindell W. Bruning, Jr. Before we begin with the case, though, I neglected to thank Judge Robert Davidson for the use of his courtroom. I realize that our coming into this courtroom or this courthouse is a major undertaking, a great inconvenience to the judge and the members of the staff here, and we greatly appreciate the accommodations that are being made in order for us to bring the court for the benefit of the high school students as well as the local bench and bar and the community at large. So we're very acknowledgeable. We acknowledge that, and we're very grateful for the accommodation. So we will begin with the state of Ohio versus Lindell Bruning, and for the appellant, Mr. Van.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please this court. My name is Daniel Van. I am an assistant prosecutor from the Office of Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Bill Mason. I'm representing the state of Ohio in this case. The issue in this case is whether or not there is a gap of time in which Megan's Law is unenforceable. The 8th District in the Bruning decision and in subsequent decision held that sex offenders who were classified under Megan's Law could not be convicted for any registration violations occurring between 2008 and this court's decision in Bodike. And that is a position being advanced by Mr. Bruning today, reasoning that the provisions of Megan's Law had been repealed by the Adam Walsh Act and were not reinstated until this court's decision in Bodike.
Is that the position that has been taken by the majority of the appellate courts, that it does not apply because there is that gap?
No, Your Honor, that is not the position of the majority of the appellate courts. To my knowledge, at this time, the 1st, 2nd, 5th, and I believe most recently the 7th appellate districts have looked at this issue in terms of what was the offender's classification or requirements under Megan's Law, and whether or not that conflicted with requirements under the Adam Walsh Act. This court dealt with this issue in State of Ohio versus Gingell. That case was originally brought up on an analysis of the penalty provisions.
Does Gingell control the outcome here?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the issue in Gingell was Mr. Gingell was a sexually oriented offender under Megan's Law, was classified a Tier 3 offender under the Adam Walsh Act. And during oral arguments, I had an opportunity to review the oral arguments. During oral arguments, neither party in that case could explain or point out to anywhere in the record whether or not Gingell's violation was for a yearly verification violation or for a 90-day verification violation. The state of Ohio believes this case is distinguishable.
So what did Bruning do here?
Bruning failed. Well, going back, because we do have facts explained on the record, the facts explained by the prosecutor was taken directly from the police reports. We know that Mr. Bruning was convicted of rape in 1983. He was sentenced to 10 to 25 years in prison. In 1997, he was classified by the trial court as a sexually oriented offender, ordered to register for 10 years.
Under Megan's Law.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Right.
That duty.
What year was that?
1997.
Okay, so he was supposed to report from 1997 till 2007. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. That duty to register did not begin until he was released from prison until 2008.
Okay. So your view is that he should report under Megan's Law from 2008 till 2018?
Notwithstanding any other tolling provisions of the registration laws.
Okay.
But yes, we know from the record that Mr. Bruning initially registered his address in November of 2008. Sometime in June 2008. He moves out of his primary residence in Cleveland. And
he moved to Parma.
Yes,
which is a suburb.
Yes.
Okay.
In August of 2009, he completes a verification form listing the primary address still as Cleveland, Ohio, with the secondary address of Parma Heights, Ohio. Later on, December 2009, Cuyahoga County Sheriff's Office, they receive a tip from the actual resident of the Cleveland address indicating that Mr. Bruning was not living there. And further follow-up, I just learned that he is actually living full-time in Parma Heights, Ohio.
But he had provided that address as well.
He provided it as a secondary address, essentially telling sheriffs, I'm not living here full-time. I may be found here. I may be located here. And I think part of the issue with that, at least at the time that eSORN was set up at the time, it would not list Mr. Bruning's secondary address on the eSORN system. That information was relayed
to me. What year did he report the Parma Heights address to the Sheriff's Department?
He had reported it over and over again. I believe he reported it in August of 2009 as a secondary address, but he did not report that address as his primary, I am living here from a day-to-day basis.
So,
did he report it in 2010?
I believe by the time 2010 comes around, he's indicted in the case.
Okay.
So what changed in terms of his reporting requirements under the Adam Walsh Act?
Some requirements did change, Your Honor. Because he was classified as a Tier 3 offender, certain requirements changed. Indeed, his 10-year requirement became a lifetime requirement under the Adam Walsh Act. The annual verification became a 90-day verification, but the one thing that did not change between Megan's Law and the Adam Walsh Act was that duty to provide the sheriff 20 days in advance a notice of change of residence address.
Okay, so you have notice of the Parma address. They indict him. And if we go back to the Megan's Law, what is the penalty for that? What was the penalty the prosecutor sought?
In this case, the prosecutor sought through the plea agreement, a second-degree felony.
And how many years would that be?
That would have been 8 years.
So he would get 8 years for the fact that he put down two addresses. One was he listed as primary, one he listed as secondary. And for that, your prosecutor's office indicted him and is seeking 8 years incarceration.
Correct, Your Honor, because the state of Ohio's position is that provision of the statute 2950-99, which Mr. Bruning argues cannot be applied to him as further evidence that he was indicted under the Adam Walsh Act. But the state's position is that particular statutory provision was amended separately through Senate Bill 97. It went into effect on January 1st, 2008, and this is an increase in the felony level for a new offense, the new offense being the new registration violation.
Wasn't he subsequently indicted on a new rape? So isn't that how this all came to the fore,
yes,
that he raped,
yes,
another
Honor.
Child? So has he been convicted of that rape?
Yes, Your Honor. This came about because he was indicted and he pled guilty to raping a child who was a neighbor in Parma Heights.
And so there's a tampering with evidence and a registration that the 8th District set aside, but the rape conviction stood. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And I would note in this case that Mr. Bruning was also indicted for failure to verify. Mm-hmm. It's the state's position after looking at the Gingell case, looking at the facts of this case, that verification, that August 2009 verification, was something he wasn't required to do under Megan's Law. That was a 90-day verification. So under Gingell, state is not seeking reversal of that portion.
So is the question for us whether or not he has properly registered the Parma Heights address, or is it the question of whether he has any obligation at all to register under Megan's Law, given the fact that the Adam Walsh Act registration had been obliterated?
Your Honor, to any extent that Mr. Bruning would argue that he can't be convicted of failure to notify based on his conduct of providing the secondary address. He made a knowing and voluntary plea of guilty. He pled guilty to the failure to notify. The only question is whether or not Bodike and Williams demands that these convictions be vacated. And it's been
because there is no reporting requirement. Is that what the argument is?
Correct, Your Honor. And that's
based on the determination that we made that the Attorney General cannot reclassify under the Adam Walsh Act.
Correct, Your Honor.
What's the penalty under the Adam Walsh Act for this activity?
In the version that went into it, the statute that went into effect January 1st, 2008, the penalty in this case should have been a first-degree felony based on the conviction of rape. I understand that there are also issues in this case with regards to the plea, the issues about the court indicating that these offenses should merge, and I think we are constrained to that.
My question is, for the failure to register, notify the sheriff of the change of address, the violations, et cetera, not the rape issues, but for that offense under Adam Walsh, what would the penalty have been versus the penalty under the Megan's Law?
The penalty that's in effect after January 1st, 2008, amended for Senate Bill 97, is first-degree felony up to 10 years. And that, again, because under...
That's prospective.
Prospective, I would argue. Prospective.
Okay, but he is classified rightfully under Megan's Law.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that was an 8-year sentence for this activity.
Correct, Your Honor.
In addition to the sentence for the actual rape of the minor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which was how much for that?
I believe he received 15 years, 5 years on the 5 years each on each count of unlawful sexual conduct, rape, sexual battery, all run consecutively in that case.
I think what we're all interested in is this a case in which we can cleanly answer the question after Bodike, was Megan's Law back in effect and properly applied to people in that gap or not? That's the question that I think everybody thinks needs answered, but is that so cluttered up by factual issues as to whether or not it's even appropriate to convict under Megan's Law when he has in fact provided this address, although it was secondary? Do we have to deal with that, or can we get right to the question that everybody wants an answer to?
Your Honor, I think we can get directly to the question because the 8th District's opinion in this case has left the state without an opportunity to convict Mr. Bruning of the registration offenses, holding that it was his convictions for these offenses were based on an unlawful reclassification. The state, again, argued in the brief thoroughly that...
Well, he wasn't convicted under Adam Walsh, right? He was convicted under Megan's Law.
Your Honor, he was... At the time he was indicted, it was as an Tier 3 offender because this indictment came before this court's in Bodike. The litigation was still going on. So there's no doubt that he was...
Did he plead to a violation of the Adam Walsh Act or a violation of Megan's Law?
Your Honor, he pled guilty to tampering with records and failing to provide... the change of address. When we look at the statutes, the 2950.05 that existed immediately prior to the Senate Bill 10 version and the version that exists now, the enforcement provision, the language only refers to failure to change of address.
It sounds like the problem here is muddled, and this isn't a good case for us to even give the answer because he's indicted under the Adam Walsh Act, right?
Your Honor, I think this is an appropriate case to
Yes or no, was he indicted under the Adam Walsh Act?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and he pleads, and you're equivocating with us as to whether he pled under Megan's Law or under the Adam Walsh Act?
Well, it's Your Honor, if I may, if the
so which did he plead to?
He did plead guilty to the Adam Walsh Act violation because that was what was.
And haven't we held that you cannot properly do that because the Attorney General is the one who made the classification as a Tier 3 offender?
Correct, Your Honor. This court did determine that it's unconstitutional for the Attorney General to do the reclassification. But I think what distinguishes this case from the Gingell case is we are not dealing with an increased registration requirement. It is, again, a requirement that remained unchanged under Megan's Law.
So whether it was Megan's Law or Adam Walsh, he still did not comply. And then it's interchangeable. The question is, can he be found guilty under the Megan's Law?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the state's position that he can be found guilty of the Megan's Law. And
Counsel, I'm sorry. Let me try to get a clarification answer. And that is, in terms of there were indictments in this case, right?
Yes.
Did it make a specific reference to the Adam Walsh Act as opposed to the Megan's Law Act? Or did it make a reference to a section of the statute which really didn't change between either one of them?
In this particular indictment, it made reference to a statute that didn't change very much between Megan's Law and the Adam Walsh Act. I will acknowledge that we did have some indictments that made reference to the tiered classification, but in this case, there was no reference to the Adam Walsh Act classification. The indictment was alleging that Mr. Bruning had failed to provide the notice of change of address.
So then the only issue was the penalty. So you're saying, because I want to make sure I'm clear, that the statute he was indicted under is the same regardless if you look at Adam Walsh or Megan's Law. It's only the penalty that's different. So the conviction should stand because that's what he pled guilty to, but there should be a new penalty applied. Is that your argument?
Well, Your Honor, this court did recently take in the case in a case on the penalty provision, State versus Howard. I will say that I believe that there is a conflict on the issue of the penalty, with the 1st and 5th District holding that these new penalties can apply to Megan's Law offenders, with the 2nd District and the 8th District disagreeing. And I would say even if this court were to ultimately determine that those penalties cannot apply to Mr. Bruning, the appropriate remedy is similar to the 2nd District's approach, such as in State versus Milby, which is certainly to affirm the judgment of guilt or the plea, but remand the matter back for resentencing pursuant to those former statutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McDonald?
Counselor, before you get started.
You're going to get started, Counselor.
This case, we thought, presents a question we want to and should answer, but can we get to that on the facts of this case, or is that just going to be advisory in this case?
Your Honor, it's Mr. Bruning's position that this is not the best case to resolve this issue because of the defects in the sentencing.
But whether it's the best case, is it one that we can actually get there?
I believe it is. It is, Your Honor, frankly. It isn't clean and it isn't clear, but it would be relevant below, to proceedings below, down the line, whether or not the Megan's Law can be applied to Mr. Bruning. So it is Mr. Bruning's position that this isn't the best case, and there are other cases that are coming before this court.
And when you talk about whether or not Megan's Law can be applied to Mr. Bruning, you mean in respect to the notification and reporting requirements?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But in Bodike at paragraph 66, this court held that we severed portions of the statute that could not be enforced. And then we said 2950.031 and 032 may not be applied to offenders previously adjudicated under Megan's Law. And then we said, and the classifications and community notification and registration orders imposed previously by judges are reinstated. So haven't we, in effect, even in Bodike, indicated that we would reinstate the classifications that had been imposed under Megan's Law?
Yes, Bodek did so indicate reinstatement, but the reinstatement was prospective from the date of Bodek, June 3rd, 2010, going forward. And any other interpretation of Bodek would fall into the same traps as the Adam Walsh Act itself fell into, which is retroactive application of a statute to offenders who have already been the subject of judicial orders. And so the retroactivity problems, the separation of powers problems.
If the Bodek was the reclassification was unconstitutional, it meant it never happened. And so the term reinstatement then is what we're arguing about. What did the court mean by reinstatement? Did it mean that it never Megan's Law requirements never left because the repeal, because the statute was unconstitutional, therefore the repeal of Megan's Law was unconstitutional, or did it mean from our decision forward we're reimposing the Megan Law requirements? Is that what we're arguing about here?
That's part of the argument, certainly. The question, I believe, in stated in simple terms, is that on August 3rd, 2009, when the offense allegedly occurred in this case, was there a sex offender registration law that was in effect and that was applicable to Mr. Bruning? And at that point, in that moment in time, Megan's Law had been expressly repealed, replaced by the Adam Walsh Act, and the Adam Walsh Act was retroactively applied. So during that time, the only sex offender registration law in effect in the state of Ohio was the Adam Walsh Act. But in this court's opinion in Bodek said the Adam Walsh Act cannot be applied to offenders like Bruning. And the state admits that in this case. They admit that the Adam Walsh Act cannot be applied to
Mr.
Bruning.
So he was never classified once he was released from the institution, correct?
He was classified in 1997 as a sexually oriented offender, and then he wasn't released until 2008.
So he was classified, but he was classified under the Megan's Law. So
that's
where
correct, Your Honor.
Is Megan's Law not applied to him?
Well, by the time he had a reporting obligation,
when he was released from prison,
right? Adam Walsh had taken effect, and he had been previously classified under Megan's Law,
right,
by a judge, just like this court said in Bodek cannot happen,
right?
And therefore, when he was released, his only obligation to register as a sex offender would have been under the only sexual registration law in effect, which was the Adam Walsh Act. But Bodek, 2 years later, or 1 year later, in Bodek, this court said you cannot apply the Adam Walsh Act to offenders like Bruning. So
you say that doesn't resurrect his obligations under the Megan's Law that he had previously been classified under?
That's correct, Your Honor. Because
but you don't think that the language from Bodek allows for the resurrection of the Megan's Law provisions and apply them to your client?
That's correct.
Do you think that it only matters that you were once out and reporting under Megan's Law, and at that point the Attorney General reclassified you and put on the new provisions of Adam Walsh, but absent activity under Megan's Law outside of the institution, you're not going to be caught in that net?
No, Your Honor. It isn't the fact that he had never registered under Megan's Law. Had he been a person who was registering under Megan's Law and then switched over to Adam Walsh,
yes,
the same argument, my argument would apply in the same manner, because the argument is that there was no law in effect that...
But our decision in Bodek said that the Attorney General had no power to reclassify, but it never said that all the orders that the judges originally put in place are now gone also. They all were resurrected because the Attorney General had no right to reclassify. And if the Attorney General had no right to reclassify, it meant that the original orders of the judges stood. And what you're trying to say is, no, the period between the passage of AWA and our finding it unconstitutional was a no man's land, and nobody had an obligation to register under either the original classification or the new classification. That's your position, correct?
That is my position.
And if we found that the Attorney General had no power to reclassify, that left intact all the judge's original orders, did it not?
It did not, Your Honor, because...
But did we ever say in it that all the original orders are also gone? We just said the Attorney General can't do anything to them.
let me clarify my answer a little bit. It did not resurrect those orders for that period of time when the Adam Walsh Act was the only registration law.
So that's really the crux of our issue. That's the crux of our issue then, is when we decided Bodike and we said the Attorney General has no power to do this, did it also throw out all those orders and you have to go back and get all new orders from the judges? Or did it say those old orders still stood, Attorney General can't do what it stands, the old orders are still good?
It said the old orders are still good from the date of Bodike, June 3rd, 2010, going forward.
Okay, so that's our issue, is are the orders good from the day they were issued, or is there a gap in here where the orders are no good because AWA is in there?
Exactly. And the orders are also good prior to the effective date of the AWA, January 1st, 2008. So it's only that gap in the law. And the problem with applying Bodike retroactively is that it would be imposing criminal liability on individuals under a law that did not exist at the time.
There's a difference between applying it retroactively and saying that the Attorney General couldn't do what it did, it couldn't throw out or change the judge's orders, therefore they're still good on the books. There's a difference between retroactivity and saying those orders still stand that were originally decided. I mean, that was the whole crux of Bodike, is the Attorney General can't throw the judge's orders out. So why would we create this gap by artificially saying it's only prospective? That's where I'm really having trouble understanding your argument.
Well, there's also Williams, which the issue of retroactivity. And that's why this idea of criminal liability after the fact for a law that the individual was not subject to.
He was always subject to registration, though. That's where he was always subject to registration. There is no retroactivity. When he was released from prison, he was subject to registration. He was classified in 1997, which is what Justice Stratton is arguing. I'm not following your retroactivity argument.
He was subject to registration under the Adam Walsh Act, apparently, because the General Assembly had decided.
No, he was subject to registration in 1997 when the judge classified him as a sexually oriented offender.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that was for 10 years, correct, at the date that he was released from prison. So he was under Megan's Law from what's the time frame we're talking about?
Well, he was released from prison in 2008.
So from 2008 until 2018, 10-year period, he's a sexually oriented offender for that first set of felonies that we're talking about. We're not talking about the underlying rapes. We're just talking about the notifications here. So he has the Megan's Law from 2008 to 2018 with all the registration duties that Megan's Law imposes. The fact that Adam Walsh was enacted, and then under Bodike, we said the legislature did not have the power, or the Attorney General did not have the power to reclassify, simply said that this attempted more stringent registration never took effect. But that doesn't affect the 2008-2018 registration period he had.
Your Honor, it does affect the 2008 to 2010 period of that. Of that 10 years. And that is because when the General Assembly decided to repeal Megan's Law and replace it with the Adam Walsh Act and enact retroactivity provisions that were later declared unconstitutional, it created a situation where the only law on the books for that period of time was the Adam Walsh Act.
Consul. It was an unconstitutional law. Did it have any force in effect? Does an unconstitutional law have any force in effect?
Not during that period of time, and that is exactly that's the key to Mr. Bruning's argument.
Yes, but you said it had an effect to repeal the old law or supersede the old requirements. So it has some effect, but doesn't have some effect?
Your Honor, the point here is that Mr. Bruning was operating under the understanding that he had to register under the Adam Walsh Act. And as this court has discussed with the state.
Well, we understand he had all that understanding, but the question is, what did the determination of unconstitutionality mean? Did it mean it had no effect on Megan's Law? It had some effect on Megan's Law, but no effect on other parts of Megan's Law? I think your argument is it just created a gap. So
exactly. It had a
constitutional
prospective effect.
To the effect that it created something new, but it wasn't unconstitutional to the fact that it went backwards.
If I understand you correctly, I think Mr. Bruning's argument is that it's constitutional as it goes forward. But as it goes backward, it's unconstitutional for essentially the same reasons that this court found the General Assembly's action.
Counsel, if your argument is correct, let's leave sex registration and move to any other criminal statute. It's repealed and superseded by a new burglary statute, a new rape statute, a new tax law that replaces the old income tax. And somebody challenges this, and we find that's unconstitutional. But that act repealed the previous law, as it always does. The old law is there, and there are certain modifications of language. Does that mean if it's a tax law that nobody has to pay their taxes for the period of time between when the new law took effect and this court determined it to be unconstitutional, or a rape statute, or any? Does that automatically create a gap?
No, Your Honor. What created the gap in this case, and if you look at Revised Code Section 1.58, which is a general rule of statutory interpretation that says when a law is repealed, the obligations under it are still in effect, except that there's an exception. And the exception is unless there is express legislative intent to the contrary. And in this case, the express legislative intent to the contrary is the fact that the General Assembly decided to enact retroactive reclassification provisions, apply them retroactively, and replace any Megan's Law duties with Adam Walsh duties.
So the unique part is that they tried to go back and make it
exactly
retroactive,
Your Honor. And
that creates the gap.
Exactly. And it was overreaching by the legislature, and respectfully, it's not this court's duty to clean up the mess that was made by the legislature.
Do it all the time.
They do it all the time.
And I think that there's a clean solution in this case, which is that Bodike is a prospective remedy that makes sense under the circumstances.
Did your client violate Megan's Law?
Well, Your Honor, the facts of the case, which this court has pointed out, are somewhat. It's a somewhat close case, and as I said at the beginning, the defects in the plea and the sentencing make this a difficult case to decide that issue. But Mr. Bruning pled guilty based on a representation that his offenses would be merged into an 8-year sentence. In effect, in actuality,
all of the offenses, the rapes and everything, was going to be 8 years.
The three registration offenses.
Okay, and that's exactly what he got.
He got 21 years, Your Honor. And he got 21 years for reversing the primary versus secondary address in this case.
So assuming for the purpose of argument only that we do not adopt your argument here, this case still has to go back for determination of that issue, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I see that my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Vann, you've exceeded your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Counsel, I keep seeing in a lot of these cases tampering with evidence. What's the basis of tampering with evidence?
The tampering with records is brought in cases where a defendant completes the registration form and providing false information on that registration.
So you hit them twice. You hit them for providing false information. You hit them for tampering with evidence by doing that?
Well, in certainly cases. I believe the state has that right to, can indict that way. But definitely, like, as we, indicated in the plea agreement or during the plea, that those offenses could be subject to merger after you look at the conduct. And, frankly, if we still had the failure to verify and the tampering, those offenses would be subject to merger. Those offenses could be deemed allied offenses of similar import depending on the conduct. I would just say, Your Honors, in this case, we're looking at the indictment, and they're arguing that this was an Adam Walsh Act indictment. But the indictment alleged a violation of of conduct, failing to provide the notice of change of address. We have the record of Mr.
It only referenced a statute number.
Correct, and provided the language
of the statute.
Correct.
And the statute was the same whether it was Megan's Law or Adam Walsh.
There were slight variations in
the variations affect Mr. Bruning.
Not in this case, Your Honor, because the allegation, which Mr. Bruning knew, was a failure to provide the notice of change of residence address. That conduct that Mr. Bruning committed was a violation under both Megan's Law and the Adam Walsh Act. So
the frequency of registration is not the issue. It's the content of what he said at the time of the registration or the information he relayed. And that would have been the same under Megan's Law or Adam Walsh.
Correct, Your Honor. And Mr. Bruning,
the penalties are different.
Yes, Your Honor. That is a separate sentencing issue. And the state would ask this court to reverse the decision of the 8th District. And in this case in particular, remand this case on the issue of the plea agreement left unaddressed. The state believes that we are unable to not only prosecute Mr. Bruning for registration offenses, but any sex offender in that gap time period for their violations, even if they were could have been violations under Megan's Law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?